The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Slavoj Žižek is a senior researcher at the Institute of Sociology at the University of Ljubljana, Slovenia, and he's been a visiting professor at Columbia, Princeton, and the New School. His work is controversial and has gained him a large following internationally, of which you are part of it. A philosopher and psychoanalyst, he is the author of more than 30 books and is the subject of the documentary Žižek, with an exclamation point. His own critically acclaimed documentary, The Pervert's Guide to Cinema, was the subject of a film retrospective in 2007 at the Museum of Contemporary Art. Professor Žižek is often described as a cultural critic, and I believe he also happily accepts the title of mischief maker. One bio notes that he has an encyclopedic grasp of political, philosophical, literary, artistic, cinematic, and pop cultural currents, that he has no qualms about throwing all of them into the stockpot of his imagination, is the prime reason he has dazzled his peers and confounded his critics for over 10 years. After reading Violence, his new book, I have renewed respect for the pungent flavors of the stockpot. I think you will enjoy that stockpot tonight. In conversation with Professor Žižek is Jack Miles, who is Senior Fellow for Religious Affairs with the Pacific Council on International Policy and the Distinguished Professor of English and Religious Studies at UC Irvine. Jack is a MacArthur Fellow and is the recipient of the 1996 Pulitzer Prize for God, a Biography, which has been translated into 16 languages. He's a former member of the Los Angeles Times editorial board and currently general editor of the forthcoming Norton Anthology of World Religions. From a statement on the website of the International Journal of Žižek Studies, which I just love, Žižek readily challenges people trying to sum him up. Hence, his presence on the board of the journal is unsettling rather than anything else, unsettling in a positive way. Anyone who tried to pin him down would be beating him up, intellectually speaking. Since Žižek is very alive, he is able to kick back, interrupt encapsulations, celebrations, as well as criticisms. So expect some kicking back tonight as Professor Žižek and Professor Miles take us on a mind-bending examination of the concept of violence, how we perceive it and how we misperceive it. Is capitalism possible without violence? Is the total elimination of violence even desirable? Tonight we consider those ideas with our guests, and I do believe God and Job will also be thrown into the stock pot. So please welcome Jack Miles and Slavoj Žižek.
If our contemporaries agree on anything, it is that violence is a bad thing. Whatever is making headlines around the world, we can count on statesmen in some conventional way to say our main goal is to lower the level of violence. But the thesis of Slavoj Žižek's book, Violence, which will be on sale afterward, is that there is such a thing as emancipatory violence, liberating violence. Violence is not always a bad thing. It is sometimes a good thing. And since we are here in a city where Spanish is the second language and perhaps en route to becoming the first, I thought I would open the conversation this evening with a line from Che Guevara, which is quoted toward the end of Violence, and ask Slavoj to comment on this. Hay que endurecerse sin perder jamás la ternura. It is necessary to harden oneself without ever losing tenderness. What do you think was meant by that? And is that the key to rehabilitating the notion of emancipatory violence?
Oh, thanks. I'm very glad to be here. I'm proud to be here with you. I do read your books. Especially the second biography, how should I put it? Yes, to go to your question, all I can do is to distinguish it from misreadings. I think it's maybe in this, only in this way I can somehow indicate what I'm aiming at. The most obvious understanding of this line from Che Guevara would have been this standard, vaguely orientalist, spiritualist way of you kill if necessary, killed out, you should sometimes be violent out of necessity, but do it with inner peace, with love, with proper withdrawal, and so on and so on. I claim that if there is anything in the spirit of Christianity, which I think for every radical politics is worth being faithful to its legacy, it's precisely the rejection of this attitude of be engaged in the world, but not fully. Maintain a distance, maintain inner peace. Now I will jump to a horrible person, but who had the same problem. And I think there is a lesson to be learned there. Heinrich Himmler. You know that his sacred book was Bhagavad Gita. Why? He all the time, that's what I read in his biography, carried in his pocket a special leather edition of Bhagavad Gita. He said it very openly. His problem was, yes, SS officers had to do horrible things, killing even children. How to do it without you becoming a beast yourself? And his answer was Bhagavad Gita. Retain a proper distance, don't fully engage, and so on and so on. I think it's absolutely crucial, again, to distinguish these two. The way I try to read Che Guevara, and by the way, I'm not idealizing him in any way, it's just a nice line, to connect it, maybe now I can give you back the question. Where do I see emancipatory violence? Oh my God, with Christ. You know that there is a big enigma, at least with the theologies that I know, maybe you are not know much more here, can give me better sources, how to read these two lines of Christ. On the one hand, you know, when somebody hits your right side, turn the left and don't strike back, like this, almost superhuman patience, and the famous one, the whole series of pretty violent statements, like, for example, like the famous, I don't bring love or harmony, whatever, peace, sorry, peace, I bring sword, or the one who doesn't hate his mother, the whole family, basically, no, is not my follower, and so on, all that stuff. I claim that here we must take it quite literally. The point is not that hatred is just a subordinated neat instrument to greater love. It's not just a deplorable means that we need to do it. For example, I forgot who, but an intelligent theologist made a very nice remark when he said that, set in its proper context, the very idea of when somebody hits your left cheek, turn the right, is in itself an extremely violent idea, in the sense that it disturbs the normal run of things. And that would be for me, if you ask me, the fundamental violence, in a good sense, emancipatory, of Christianity for me. If you allow me, I hope I don't misuse the time, very brief, why? Because many people think, like, I'm a little bit crazy here, like an old kind of Marxist, although a strange Marxist who was prohibited to get a job in old years. Like, what am I looking for in Christianity? What interests me is precisely what does it mean, Holy Ghost as the community of believers, and what radically changes with Christ. And I think the violence of the cut of Christ is what? To simplify things to the utmost. The pagan ethics before, the basic rule there is, it is the good is harmony. Harmony in the sense of each at his or her or their own place. This is also the whole idea of karma. Things must reproduce themselves in a harmonious, balanced way. Right. I'm simplifying it, but basically I hope I'm not totally wrong. The elementary zero level form of evil is when a partial element explodes.
Sets itself against the whole.
Like, and incidentally, to give you a funny detail, when I visited China, you know, now they no longer even use the term communism. Their preferred term now is the old Confucian one, harmonious society, no? So I asked them, couldn't you simply, like in a nutshell, explained to me what do you mean by harmonious society. They told me it's a society where everybody is at here her own place. The manager leads, the worker works, the mother is a mother. I told them, oh my God, now we know what we talk about. Forget about cultural differences. In Europe, we call this fascism, no, if I remember correctly. No. But going back, that's the basic idea. Excess, no, as already Confucius put it, you know, a king should be a good king. Like, it's the key to, how to put it, you do your role in the global order by fully meeting the demands of the particular position within this global order, which is, as it were, meant for you. It's all this organicist, corporatist metaphor and so on and so on. I think with Christianity, things radically change.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I think
turning the other cheek. May I please respond to your what I think is involved in the turning the other cheek.
In the turning, yeah, okay, please, yes.
The notion, he says, the line is if you are struck on your left cheek, turn your right as well. Well, a master would rebuke a servant not by striking him this way. That's how he would attack an equal. But an inferior, he would strike.
Yeah.
And so you would be hit on the left side of your face, and you would be rebuked. And if you were playing your proper role in society, there is where the exchange would end. If instead you turned back and required him now to hit you on the right side of the face, you would be provoking him to greater violence than he intended to perform. And you would be disrupting the social fabric by inducing that potential shame in him. You would be requiring him then to assume a posture of hyper-correctness, of hyper-conformity to his own code, and by doing that, you would induce him to break the code. It's in this way that these postures of pacifism are not actually postures of surrender. They are postures of another kind of aggression that doesn't involve striking a blow. In the Norton Anthology of World Religions that we're working on, we divide the religions into religions of prophecy, which are essentially Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and religions of wisdom. The religions of wisdom seek equilibrium and balance. The religions of prophecy seek disruption.
Yes, that would be my point. One of the names, sorry, for violence is disruption.
This is why, as it seems to me, comes through in Zizek's writings all over the place, Christianity is a kind of propaedeutic for revolution, and the secular revolution is just a logical extension of the program. Isn't that your view?
Yeah. For example, let's return to that Christ, the one who doesn't hate father, mother, and so on. I think hate means here hate them as father, mother, as particular roles, and so on, within the social whole. I think that the community of believers in Christianity is precisely not the harmonious social whole. It's a kind of egalitarian community, egalitarian in the sense that it cuts across the organic social structure. This is, I think, the deepest idea that you, as a particular individual, you can, as it were, directly participate in the universal, not by playing your particular role and so on and so on.
Not by being a part of your people.
Yeah.
And so Jesus never promises anybody a baby.
Yeah. This is also why, in a wonderful line, you must know much more about this than me, in Paul's writings, he apparently takes over the organicist metaphor but always turns it around.
You mean the mystical body of Christ?
Yeah, mystical, but then he says, but we are the lowest, the feet, and so on. He turns it around. It's profoundly anti. Now I come to the next point, which is for me. So one thing in this one, forget about all that stuff of karma in the sense of our past deeds are dragging behind, you have to pay. No, the idea is the general, how should I call it, turn of things, this harmonious reproduction of nature, fate, however you call it, there can be a cut. It can be stopped. Mm-hmm. And this is what, now, I'm moving fast like crazy, but I hope to be able to say that in my books I develop it a little bit more. Here I see a line, Christianity, Descartes, cogito, German idealism. And finally, Freud. Freudian name for this cut For this cat which interrupts the flow, it's death drive.
Is what?
Death drive.
The death drive.
The death drive. I think if you look at Freud closely, you can see, if you read him, it has nothing to do with any kind of a nirvana instinct and so on and so on. Would you agree with this? If you look closely, what Freud aims at when he talks about death drive is something which insists beyond life and death, which just goes on. I claim paradoxically that Freud's death drive is his name for immortality. For a strange immortality in the sense of something which insists. Death drive means what, to go to popular culture, why not, you know, Stephen King, the undead. The undead, neither alive nor dead. In this sense, dead but still alive.
And so love is kind of unlove too, isn't it?
Yeah.
Eros and Thanatos are not everyday affection and everyday hospital room death. There's something
no love has nothing. Christian love has nothing to do with sentimentality. Yes, which is why, as Kierkegaard says in his works of love, a true Christian believer is ready to kill his neighbor out of love. Love, authentic love, is cold love. It's love which relates to the neighbor. And we can go on. This is
let me bring up something that reading your book brought back into my mind. Some in the audience may have seen an article in The New Yorker a while back by Jared Diamond, the author of Guns, Germs, and Steel, and Collapse, and a number of other books. In this article, he drew on a personal history, not his own, but through his wife, who is the child of Holocaust survivors. The Holocaust survivor in this family, late in life, confided something with a strange sort of shame to the younger generation in his family. Near the end of the war, he had been by an odd chance, in a position to wreak vengeance upon his tormentor in the camp. The Germans had lost the war. German-speaking Jews were working with the Americans in prosecution of war criminals. It was that time, or it was approaching that time. But given this opportunity to wreak vengeance, he didn't seize it. Instead, he acted mercifully. But his experience of himself in subsequent years was not an experience of pride or quiet satisfaction that he had done the right thing. He felt ashamed of himself for not doing this. And you talk in your book about the need to rehabilitate the notion of resentment, to stop deferring the satisfaction of our rage to God at the end of time and to sort of take it upon ourselves. You claim even rather than to claim that it is arrogating the power of God when we inflict punishment, even capital punishment, on someone, we're arrogating the power of God to ourselves when we presume to forgive, when we presume to be merciful. Say more about that. Why do you think that we need to somehow rehabilitate these notions that it seems our whole culture, perhaps our whole post-Christian culture, teaches us to tame, to suppress resentment, rage, things of that sort?
Okay. Here we can approach this problem at a rather superficial level, talk about today's ideology, not ideology in the superficial sense of big conflicts, big visions, but ideology in the sense of like our everyday sense of humanity, what means to be human and so on. And there, the feature which makes me suspicious is our focus expressed through political correctness and so on harassment. Mm-hmm. This idea that practically everything that a neighbor does, like I look at you into the eye, harassment, rape, and so on. What terrifying anthropology is here implicit, where whatever the other does have this edge of potentially aggressing me, and I claim that this is what is false with our predominant notion of tolerance. it really stands for its opposite. Tolerance means don't harass me. Don't harass me means don't come too close to me. So tolerance de facto means I don't tolerate your over proximity. Tolerance means basically don't come too close to me.
Back off, right.
Yeah, back off, yes. And I think, now we come to the point that paradoxically, precisely the price we are paying for violence being such a taboo is that at a different level, violence is returning with a vengeance for all those who don't play our game of tolerance and so on. But more fundamentally, you know what would have been my answer if your suspicion is, am I not going too far in this praising violence, like are these not dangerous waters and so on. Okay, I could have done it in theological-philosophical way by referring to Walter Benjamin and draw on the distinction between what Benjamin calls mythic violence and divine violence. To avoid a misunderstanding, we both knew it, maybe not all of you. For Benjamin, divine violence is not Al-Qaeda, it's not somebody pretending to act on behalf of God. It's almost the opposite. It's violence which is, as he puts it somewhere, means without end, a kind of emancipatory explosion, which is not this liberal topic, has nothing to do with this liberal topic of let's be a little bit violent to prevent greater crime or whatever. What I'm saying is that if by violence, and this is an obsessive motive of my work, I hope we both agree here, if by violence one means what your noble Vice President still Dick Cheney once referred as the dark side of power, like we will have to do certain thing in hiding, but let's not talk about it and so on. This violence I'm radically opposed to, and I've written extensively on it. This is what fascinates me so much in our ideology, how it, in order to function, it has to be sustained with a, how should I call it, violent, some obscene violent supplement. Like what always impressed me in Hollywood movies, probably they reflect real life about Marines, is how you have military discipline and so on. And then you have all those obscenities like marching chants, all those songs, very sadistic, talking about burning children, raping women and so on. All this is not a joke. The military establishment needs this obscenity. Another aspect of this violence would have been carnival. You know how people, many leftists even, celebrate carnival, wonderful moment when the rules are suspended, you can do whatever you want. King
anarchy,
is be-
right.
Sorry?
Anarchy.
Yeah, we know who is the greatest theoretician of carnival in the 20th century, the Russian fellow traveler of formalists, Mikhail Bakhtin, in his book. But you know what they now discovered when they found his notes, only now, a friend from Russia told me, that you know what was Bakhtin's model of carnival? Stalinist purges. Ah. One big carnival. Today, member of Politburo, tomorrow, English spy. Off you go to Gulag.
And well, we
so
do
on.
Call them show trials, don't
Sorry?
We? Sorry? We do call them show trials.
Yeah, yeah, which is why, isn't this, can you imagine a more carnivalesque social order than Stalinism at its high point? When, do you remember, from 34 to 37, 75% of Central Committee were shot, 80% of General Headquarters of the Army were shot, and so on. So what's my message here? It's, how should I put it, don't get caught in this false celebration of liberating violence. Can I make another point which may be of some interest to you? Now, a guy who is in Hague, we all know Radovan Karadzic, the leader of Bosnian Serbs.
I was hoping this would come up, yeah.
Yeah, I read some of his poems, and I should tell you, I was quite impressed by them. The guy knew what he was doing. There is a wonderful poem addressing his followers, where he said, oh, brothers, join me in my new faith. Nothing is forbidden. You will get inclemency, wine. This Godhead will allow you to do whatever you want, and so on. Why am I saying this? Because I think, as already Theodor Adorno knew it, this is how should I call it, so-called totalitarianism or fundamentalism gets you. keeps its hold on you. It's not a stupid, simplified sociologists are telling us, today we live in a society of choice, you have to decide everything so people escape from freedom. No, totalitarianism promises you this kind of a false liberation. I visited Serbia, I will stop immediately. Some 15 years ago, I talked with some ethnic cleansers, and they gave me the lesson of a lifetime. They told me, no, what, we are not afraid of freedom, on the contrary. They told me, your liberal society, what freedoms you have there? You cannot smoke in public, you cannot rape a woman if you like her, you cannot kill a guy if you don't like him. I become a nationalist, I go to Bosnia to do a little cleansing, I can do all of this. And isn't this the true message you get always in totalitarianisms?
No, I have to, you're Slovenian by birth, yeah. And a world citizen perhaps.
Bodily
no.
birth.
Bodily birth, right. During my last years on the editorial board of the Los Angeles Times, by chance, I had the responsibility for writing just about all of the Times' editorials on the conflict in the Balkans. Well, the war between Yugoslavia and the Serb-dominated Yugoslav army and Croatia went on for years. The war with Bosnia went on for years. Of course, Kosovo was the last violent chapter. But an early chapter was the Serb-dominated army's invasion of Slovenia, and the Slovenes defeated them in 2 weeks. Was this emancipatory violence? And number two, how did they do it?
No, let's be serious. I mean, Slovenes.
I understand. This is a cheapening of the phrase. I quite realize that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a journalistic intrusion. So forgive me. I understand what we're not doing. But I'm still curious. How did they do it?
No, they didn't do it. I mean, we did. We did defend ourselves. But look, let's be clear. It wasn't a real war. It was a little bit of shooting here, there. Everything was decided in advance. We did something pretty intelligent, and we were lucky. The intelligent thing was to know that at that point, when Slovenia decided to leave Yugoslavia, it wasn't because of any great nationalist dreams. 80% of the people were still for some form of confederacy. But we all knew Milosevic is catastrophe. Milosevic means war. So the majority of Slovenes, I guarantee you, wanted to leave Yugoslavia just simply to avoid war. That was so tragic about Yugoslav war. Everybody knew, except stupid Western powers, what is coming there. So what we did is we counted on something else. This was the very beginning of a conflict when the Yugoslav army was still ethnically mixed. Serbs were only 40%, so we knew they really cannot fully deploy their units. They cannot count on them. And that was the whole trick, just to keep them blocked and counting that they cannot fight. Now, the only solution for them would have been to use the planes. But in the aviation, 70% of the pilots were Slovenes and Croats. So they couldn't count on that. It was wonderful manipulation. And we did early enough. Croats started their independence a little bit later. It was already too late. Literally, in a matter of months, under the domination of the Serbs, Yugoslav army was totally disorganized. But what I wanted to tell you here is maybe...
Were the pilots Serbs? After
sorry?
That?
Of course, yes. I mean, of course, they changed. The whole structure changed, yes. But what I wanted to tell you is that, you know, the Yugoslav crisis is, for me, a big example of Western ideological perceptions. The phrase I like to use here is the one by Gilles Deleuze, the French guy, you know. Si vous êtes pris dans le rêve de l'autre, vous êtes foutu. If you are caught into another's dream, you are lost. The common journalistic phrase was, in Balkan, we are half crazy. We are caught in our medieval dreams.
Forget
about them. We were playing, if at all, this role for the West, which is why I really hate, I must say, the Bosnian movie director Emir Kusturica. His film Underground, it's, I think, the most racist, self-humiliating film I can imagine. If you had the misfortune of seeing it, what kind of image do you get of Balkan there? A crazy part of Europe where people fornicate, drink, fight, eat all the time. This is what the West wants to see in ex-Yugoslavia. Go to Sarajevo. The shock is there is nothing folkloric about Sarajevo. They have the central Muslim part which is kept alive for the tourists, basically. But it's a normal, very enlightened society with greatest rock bands in ex-Yugoslavia, whatever you want. All this folklorization, Balkan mythic country, was here to mystify a basic, very simple point, I claim. Nothing to do with old traditions. The Yugoslav communist nomenklatura faced a problem in the middle and late 80s. After the economic fiasco, how to legitimize its rule? They found a way, nationalism. And Milosevic perfected this formula. His formula was, let's bring together the unification between party nomenklatura and nationalist intellectuals, which is why, to be slightly ironic, in my old age, I'm becoming almost sympathetic towards Plato's idea of throw out the poets from the city. As I like to repeat it, you in the West may have the industrial military complex, we have what I call poetic military complex. That is to say, poets getting together with...
Would you go so far to say the poetic psychoanalytic military complex? I mean, Karadzic was a psychoanalyst, right?
Here I must defend my colors. No, he was a New Ager Jungian. He was a Jungian. No, the name of class struggle in psychoanalysis is Freud versus Jung. I remember.
I see.
No, wait a minute. It's easier for me. Most of them are in SERP. I read his wisdoms and so on. You know, he was quite efficient, but his lesson was a basic New Age stuff. Deep into yourself, discover your true self. And as my beloved Christian theologist Gilbert Chesterton points it so nicely, if there is one thing I like about Judeo-Christian tradition, it's X-Files aspect. That is to say, the truth is out there. In Christianity, you encounter truth. Truth is not in this typical Gnostic mode. Here, maybe we disagree. In my Christian Stalinist universe, it would have looked bad for John's gospel. Maybe not Gulag. He needs 2 years of re-education camp. No, he already has a little bit of this Gnostic. I claim the whole point is, and that's already, if you know a little bit, I simplify, but nonetheless, about Jewish religion. What's so great in it? The idea is Jews were chosen. Nobody knows why. They were good, ordinary people, and then, my God, why didn't God leave us alone?
It was Chesterton's short poem was no, how odd of God to choose the Jews.
Yeah, no, I mean, but you got the idea. This idea that truth is not deep in yourself. It's not this inner peace. Truth is a traumatic, painful encounter. And here also we have, but that's a different story, a difference between Freud and Jung and so on and so on.
I think we're edging toward Job, but just to say a word about John, Elaine Pagels has a terrific explanation of the Gospel of John as a built-in refutation of Gnosticism, saying you get a superior version of it in Orthodox Christianity. And this refutation is built in by including Thomas, who's the Gnostic hero, in the Gospel, and having him demand proof in a very objective, fleshy way and get it. So there is a kind of haze of Gnostic thrill, I would say, about the Gospel of John. But finally, it belongs in the canon with the other three Gospels.
Yeah, but we all know how the canon was decided, in that, to use contemporary terms, central committee meeting of the Christian Church around. I mean, we know that.
I don't think so. No, the canon had been determined by a kind of people voting with their feet in the several cities. Remember, these Gospels were not written in Palestine. They were written around the Mediterranean in different cities, and they became popular in their cities of origin, too popular for any central power to rule them out. So finally they
But who draw the line nonetheless at the end and say Thomas is out?
Again, I would say the conventional answer you begin to hear sometimes is Constantine, but I don't think so. The canon was there before Constantine. It's just that from that point on, as Orthodox Christianity became the state religion and had the power of the emperor behind it, the thought that a situation that had been in flux could remain in flux was left behind. But still, the essential situation had been established before he called
it. Okay, let me tell you then briefly, and you can immediately strike back knowing more than me, what's my problem with John?
The
big debate is where bad guys are for me orthodoxy in the sense of Eastern Church. For them, the Trinity is all the time out there.
And you like that?
No, I hate that.
I thought you just said you wanted it. You wanted, you liked Christianity.
No. What I prefer some radical versions of Protestantism where they claim there is no Christ, if you read it radically, prior to embodiment, incarnation. That is to say that Trinity is
no
something...
No pre-existence.
Sorry?
No pre-existence.
No pre-existence, yes. I think that's what gives Christianity its tremendous edge. And you should like it as a, in good sense, no Iron Man storyteller.
Yes.
What I mean is that what happened here on the earth, incarnation and so on, is part of divine history. It's part of God himself. It's not that God is up there sitting, pulling the strings. Okay, as we know from the book of Job, sometimes in the evening drinking coffee with devil and then making bets. No, our story is directly the story of God.
Right.
That's for me what is so uniquely shattering in Christianity.
Yes, and then, I mean, the all the theological talk in Christianity is about the metaphysical puzzle of how God could be God and be man at the same time. Rarely discussed, but much more interesting, is that at the moment when God becomes a human being, he undergoes a radical personality change.
As God himself.
God himself undergoes this shift of personality.
Yeah.
You would not have expected Yahweh, the Lord of hosts, who laid waste all Egypt, to turn the other cheek if someone came at him, would you? He wouldn't have ever said, Moses would never have said, Pharaoh's is Pharaoh's, and what is God's. You know, there wasn't that kind of abstention. So now suddenly there is, and this means then that if on the in the terms of the story, God has undergone some kind of crisis of personality. He's changed into another kind of being, and all the interest focuses on why. In the green room before we began, and here, well, let's get back into the Job thing we were talking about. The Christian story is a retelling of the Job story, and I think we agree to a very considerable extent about what the Job story means, but there is a nuance of difference. Tell us what you think it means.
I love this topic, yeah. No, first, did you notice how with Job is often happening the same as with Oedipus at Colonus? The way we usually remember it, it's in a totally falsified, I mean, in the simple empirical sense way, as if, you know, Job is the patient guy who takes every...
Yes.
No, Job protests all the time.
Right.
It's like the old Oedipus at Colonus. He's not a silent heroic figure accepting his fate. He curses everyone all the time. So what's Job's problem? Why I really think the book of Job is, I even proposed to Verso in that revolutionary series where I wrote some unfortunate introductions to Trotsky and so on, to do the book of Job. I think it's the first manual of the critique of ideology. Why? What happens? As we all know, Job is screwed up in all possible ways, loses everything and so on. And then what happens? Then ideology enters. We get the three theological friends, each of them gives him a kind of justification of, like, the message is your misfortunes have some deeper meaning.
Right.
The first one is a simplistic one, if I simplify myself. The message is God is just. So if this is happening to you, even if you don't know what, you must have done something wrong. Others are more refined, like it's the divine test of your faith. But the message is there is a deeper meaning. Then God comes, as you know, and says, everything these three, my theologists, said is wrong, and so on and so on. What is even more interesting, and this I found shattering, is how do you read it? That famous line then when God has to answer Job, like, why did all this happen? And here, spontaneously, I don't know if it's theologically or historically correct, I love Chesterton's reading. You know when God goes into what may even sound as empty boasting? Did you see those horses, like all the...
Were you there, right?
Yeah, were you there when? Yes. The way Chesterton reads it, it's not as divine boasting. It's not, who are you, miserable nobody, with all this big work that I to even... No, it's that God is, at that point, himself overwhelmed and perplexed by his own creature. It's like the message is, you think something strange is happening to you, look at the universe, the whole universe is strange and crazy and so on. So now we come to the crucial question, now we come to the point. I claim that Christ's Eli, Eli, Lama, that God, Father, why have you forsaken me, repeats the experience of Job, this radical abandonment and so on. And now we come to the point in my radical atheist Protestant reading and so on. What dies on the cross? Here I follow Hegel, who said, what dies on the cross are not is not another earthly representative of God. You totally miss it if you think God is up there, we are here, God sends his son, a mediator, okay, it didn't work, come back to me, son, we'll try maybe with second coming. No, according to Hegel, what dies on the cross, it's not just the earthly representative of God, it's the God of beyond itself, the God which, following Lacanian psychoanalysis, I would have called the big other.
This is your master signifier.
Yeah, yeah. The agency which pulls the strings. Yes. You know, as we usually say, this is the usual Christian notion. Like, you know, we do what we do. You never control the whole situation. Things may turn wrong. But we can basically rely on God. There is a higher force, good fate.
It will all add up in the end.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I think the message of that is precisely the opposite. The death of Christ means God abdicates from that role, which is best exemplified by that. I always find it disgusting and terrifying. That metaphor of a painting, you know, the idea is all evil things that we see are like stains if you look at a painting from too close. And then if you look at it at from a proper distance, you see how what previously appeared to as stain just contributes to the global harmony. The idea is it's the same with evil. Okay, are you ready to say Stalin killing 10 million, Hitler killing, or whatever in Congo in the last years, people don't like to forget this, the same story is going on now in Congo, that these are just stains because we don't have proper perspective. No, I think Christ's death is a desperate, not abdication in the sense of there is too much suffering, I cannot afford that perspective up there, I fall into, and then what happens is very intelligent theologians, conservatives that I like Paul Claudel, who has said somewhere, God is impotent without us. The message of Christ's death is, after me, it's Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit is a community of believers. The message of crucifixion is not, we can rely on Christ, it's Christ relies on us. Christ makes a wager, we, as the community of believers, emancipatory, egalitarian community, to go to the end in my provocation, the proto-communist party, the ancient name for communist party was the Holy Spirit. But you know what I mean, this, that it's not, Holy Spirit is not a transcendent power, taking care that somehow guaranteeing, it's what remains when the transcendent power abdicates, throws itself at our mercy.
Toward the end of, this is a
Do you find this too crazy?
No, I don't. There's a way. I mean, there are other nuances of difference. At the end of the book of Job, God says, as if in exhaustion, you have not spoken properly of me. He says this to those who have been defending him against Job. You have not spoken properly of me, as has my servant Job. Well, this, in saying this, God seems to be incriminating himself. And what's striking is that in the Tanakh, the Jewish ordering of Hebrew scriptures, God never speaks again. So though it's conventional to say that God silences Job, Job actually silences God as well. But what is it that God is endorsing when he says, when he says that Job has spoken properly of him? Job has been demanding meaning. He has been demanding meaning, and God endorses the demand. There is not here an endorsement of the absurdity of all things. Even if we see only absurdity, we are nonetheless right to demand order, to demand reason. If there is a kind of second occurrence of this, as the supposed savior of the world falls to total ruin, then I think it is in the form that you describe. After his resurrection from the dead, Jesus appears to his followers And the text says he breathes upon them individually. So the Holy Spirit is the Spirit of God. It is also the Spirit of Christ. He breathes upon them. And at the Last Supper, before his death, he said, you will do greater things than I did.
Yeah.
So this then is the creation of what in Christianity is called the communion of saints, or the mystical body of Christ. Collectively, Christians will now do the greater things that Jesus himself is no longer on earth to do. And if you take that notion of salvation now transferred into human hands and dispense with all theological language, you have something like a revolutionary movement, communism.
But nonetheless, we don't have time to go here into, I totally agree with you, one should be much more precise here in a more theoretical debate. But where I probably agree with you is that nonetheless, that seems to me crucial to emphasize. I will develop this in my new book, which is a polemical dialogue debate with John Milbank, Radical Orthodoxy Guy. It will be a crazy book, 500 pages. Me accusing him of the Catholic of obscene paganism, he accusing me of Protestant atheism, and so on. You will see a lot of friendly mudslinging. But what I'm saying is that there is something for me so precious in this idea of an, how should I call it, apocalyptic times nearing the end of time, and we need a community of believers in the sense of everything depends on us and so on. I think effectively, not in any paranoiac sense, not because aliens are trying to copulate with our wives or what. Don't you think that we do live in apocalyptic times?
Yes,
look at ecology. Everybody knows it can't go on. Look at another thing, which I find very interesting. Biogenetics, cognitive sciences, and so on. Listen, it terrified me that people don't see what is happening when, you know, I read somewhere scientists already can do this. What? They can directly connect your brain neuronal orders that you give to a computer so that, for example, you give the order with your brain. You just think. You say up. Computer can read it because these are simple neuronal orders. It's attached to an object and an object can move directly. But it's not even Stephen Hawking where he needs that.
No, I understand.
But are we aware that this is in a way the end of being human the way we understood it?
Abolition of man.
Yeah, because our fundamental sense of human identity is I'm in here, reality is out there. This minimum sense of autonomy and freedom. Because also remember, if I can move by my thought objects, then unfortunately it goes also the other way around.
Yes.
No, you can. So I claim that at all these different levels and others and so on, something tremendous is happening today. And I really see how the only appropriate reaction social is a new emancipatory movement. We will have to do it. I'm not saying we will do it. Although I count myself as a Marxist, I hope we both agree at least at this point that we don't have the train of history on our side.
I don't think that history offers examples of any mass movements large enough and taking shape rapidly enough to address the ecological crisis, except new religions. Nothing else seems to offer the promise of the kind of mobilization that is called for on the schedule that is called for. So what is a religion? You know, what is the difference between a religion and another kind of mass movement seeking something that seems beyond human possibility, beyond human imagination? The differences do begin to shrink. It's time for some audience participation, time for some questions.
It's time that we pretend for 20 minutes that we live in a democracy, no?
Yes, but we'll all go along with it in good spirit. So, yes, we have microphones here, don't we? Yes, right down here, second row, first seat.
I told...
I will recognize, he will answer.
Thank you.
We're pretending that it's an equality here.
I just wanted to go back to the Job point for just a moment because it seemed really, it was very interesting in terms of how the human, the image trumps the God by having faith without hope, in a sense, or faith without power. And what that led me to think was that then God responds by creating this sort of imagio, you know. And going into Lacan, it is that notion where when Job makes the demand, changing it from the O so that desire, instead of it being the desire for the other's desire, becomes the lowercase other. By making the demand, he cuts it. And the other, the large uppercase other that is God, becomes just a lowercase other, which kind of goes back to the turning the other cheek. He almost demands parity.
That's a nice question. I'm sorry. Did you finish? No, again, to answer it properly, as we both know, it would have been de facto to exclude others and engage into Lacanian theological disputes, which are, I can assure you, worse than every theory. But what I would say is that the way I read it, to put it in very precise terms, it's rather that, again, to speak Lacanese, Job's provocation is that, che vuoi, what do you want, to God? And the final answer is that the other himself doesn't know what he wants, that the abyss is there in God. That would be, for me, at least a Christian solution. That it's not God knows that, you know, which is why I like ever, I'm repetitive here, to quote that wonderful phrase from Hegel when speaking about Sphinx, Egyptians. Hegel says the enigmas, mysteries of the Egyptians for us were the mysteries for the Egyptians themselves also. That here I'm Hegelian. When we speak about the mystery of God, it's a mystery for God.
Subjective
himself.
Genitive, yes.
Yeah. In other words, here you would agree that we come back about this, that we are the story of God, that God's incarnation, revelation, is self-revelation of God himself.
It is a self-revision, it is also a self-interrogation. Well, an idea that it is at least sketched in Jung's answer to Job, that there's a marvelous recent book by Jerome Siegel called Joseph's Bones, and it notes that besides carrying the Ark of the Covenant through their desert wanderings, the Jews carried another Ark, another Aron, that had in it the bones of Joseph. Joseph is the supreme example of humane behavior in the Tanakh. And it is as if they needed to remember this alongside the commands that they received on Mount Sinai. So there are lessons that God teaches man, there are lessons that man teaches God, and they are in the same boat, in a sense. They're in the same plight of a search for meaning.
I agree here with both of you, just with another remark. I think that the first two wonderfully formulate this problem of man also as a mystery for God is, you must know this better than me, a friend of mine just told me this, that there is somewhere in Augustine a wonderful enigma he raises. Namely, if we know that God sees, you cannot lie to God, God sees into our interior, he knows, why then do we have to confess to God? You know why? And the idea is, he knows us as object, but you know, the abyss of subjectivity, even if it's nothing, that's the enigma. The enigma is the enigma of saying, even if he knows everything, saying itself creates a reality and so on, one can develop this. I mean, things are here very precise. I well understand Lacan when he's, but let me give you another.
Let's take another question. Yeah. I think I'm going to spread
this
around.
Sorry.
You
get the idea why my friends
yes.
call me Fidel. You know, like, comrades, 10 minutes and then 5 hours. Yeah, please.
Professor, you raised some very important questions, particularly since you mentioned Serbia. What should be the greater society's reaction to emancipatory violence? Shouldn't it be that let being be? The old Heidegger notion that here are people who should be among themselves. And so what happened in the old Yugoslavia was that they separated themselves after war. Now,
after you mean 91 war?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, my God. Again, I would love to debate this. I've written not books, but texts on it. I'm just afraid to be sidetracked here. You know what my answer would have been? It's a very simple one. I have no great sympathy for Tito's Yugoslavia, but it was something which worked so-so, and it was based on a very complicated network, as all communities are, of unwritten implicit rules and pacts, like Slovenia and Croatia we were allowed to develop a little bit more, but Serbs will have, because of this, stronger influence in military forces. There was a certain unwritten pact. And for me, I'm absolutely not anti-Serb. I claim Serbs as a nation have the greatest democratic potential historically. But nonetheless, the true catastrophe was Milosevic. Yugoslavia was not over when Slovenia seceded. Yugoslavia was over the moment Milosevic took power. Because he broke that implicit, how should I put it, agreement. He wanted to change the formula. And my God, not me. I wasn't a genius. All commentators, everybody knew from when did he took power? I think 86, I don't know. Everybody knew the game is everybody knew the game is over. On the other hand, you know, don't idealize Tito's Yugoslavia. It's not simply everything was good and then all this exploded. I think in a way, the war was the price we paid for that. We paid for the Tito's era and so on. No, my only conclusion is that, how to put it, don't mystify it. It could have been prevented. And I think the great, great responsibility here is that of the West, who totally misread the situation systematically.
Thanks. Next question. Do I see another hand? Right back there.
Also... Why is the left silent here? Okay. There was extreme right, not politically. Okay. Sorry.
Okay. I'm looking at my companion up here. So.
Please.
Yes.
Hi. I wanted to ask a question about, like, there's sort of two sides of violent activity. There's a person who perpetrates it, who could have the Bhagavad Gita and remain detached, autonomous. But then there's the person who absorbs the violence. And I find it really interesting when those people speak and begin to reveal what the experience was like and what it meant. And I'm wondering if you guys have any ideas on that side of the equation and the significance of that in the world.
Absolutely. This will be, it sounds already repetitive, me referring to unpublished texts, but this will be the central chapter of my forthcoming book, French philosopher Catherine Malabou, a younger one who already wrote, incidentally, if you are philosophers, one of the best books on Hegel, translated into English, L'avenir de Hegel, The Future of Hegel, I think, published at Princeton here. She wrote now a book, Le Nouveau Blessé, The New Wounded, which deals precisely with this. Her thesis is that what we usually refer to as the post-traumatic subjects, this living death, when you are exposed to extreme trauma, which can be physical, natural, social, even purely biological, like Alzheimer's or whatever, a new form of objectivity is emerging all across these differences. The post-traumatic subject, to simplify the living dead, or to put it in Heideggerian terms, you are still alive, but you are lacking, you know, if I look into your eyes, how do you call it, the spark of life, what Heidegger would have called the engaged existence, being in the world. You, as it were, survive your own symbolic death. And this, I think, is the model of it. The first enigmatic figure here would have been so-called, and it's a wonderful irony because they were mostly Jews, so-called Musulmen and Muslims, described, you know, by Levi and Maybe. So on, the living dead, the one who, and I think if we want to confront the result on the victims of new forms of violence, this is the formula. I tend to agree with Malabou that if the 20th century was the century of Freud, where the logic of violence was always this mediation of psychic and physical. Like Freud's thesis is, as we all know, that an external traumatic experience functions as a trauma only insofar as it resuscitates a pre-existing inner trauma. It's always this dialectic. But he claims today something more radical is happening. So along these lines I will go, but I agree with you that this is the crucial problem, and the problem is very difficult because it's not only it's not enough to give these uplifting profiles of how people are coping, it getting better, you know, all these stories which I otherwise like very much, which we get, for example, in Oliver Sacks and so on. No, you lose your ability to recognize faces, but through music you can reconnect and so on. What interests me is that this zero level, when you are cut off from your usual symbolic background, you still are subject, but a terrifying form of living that subject. That's something to think about, I think. That's something.
This makes me think about, you're bringing up the masturbate-a-thon in San Francisco. You seem
so embarrassed. When I gave a talk there a week ago, the lady came to me and thanked me for making propaganda for her. Okay, another story.
the issue here is whether that hollowing out, that death of the light behind the eyes, that can befall an individual human being, can befall a society as well.
Yeah.
And then when it engages, when it goes through the motions of its collective activities, we might consider an election. The light has gone out of its eyes. It's not doing the things that it once did with such verve, with such conviction, such life. Performing them as if already dead, and that's something that you address in this book. It requires some kind of shock treatment, doesn't it? A society in that condition.
But Nanda, I'm sorry, we don't have more time to enter into this. When you mentioned elections and so on, note precisely with all these mechanisms that we use today, the logic of community and so on and so on. I think, and I'm not even here critical of Republicans, everybody is, but what fascinated me so much when I was looking, every evening when I was on the tour here, this Republican convention, McCain, Sarah Palin, and so on, was the obvious gap between explicit message and, let's call it naively, the message between the lines. You know, I think that Democrats are all too naive if they focus on, but it's not really change and so on. I think that's the true message. The message is, and I think voters get it, their voters, is we will change what is necessary to change so that nothing will fundamentally really change, how should I put it, no? It's precisely what I call hyperactivity, and that now, maybe you will like it if you allow me 2 minutes literally to answer your question about my models of violence. Don't be afraid, I'm not kind of a bloodthirsty vampire. The sense in which I want to emancipate violence is the sense in which I would claim Gandhi was more violent than Hitler. Let me tell you an amusing detail. You know that I have a big conflict about this book. Almost I wanted to withdraw it because I had in it a sentence where I said the problem with Hitler was that he wasn't violent enough.
That's the closing sentence.
Yeah. But the name Hitler is not there. That was because they told me, they want to tell you he should have killed all the Jews or what? No, my point is that his violence was reactive. All his violence was a reactive violence to prevent a truly radical change cutting into the social body and so on and so on. So my point is that what Gandhi did on the other way, although it was in a way non-violent, but his organized boycott of the British administration and so on and so on, this was in a way violence in the sense of, as you put it, disruption. Interruption.
Right.
That's what we think. That's my point of violence. And as I put it there, now we come to the point, this is the part that I like because it's personal. When I said at the end, sometimes the most violent thing is to do nothing. People misunderstand.
Let me read this. I mean, I think it's nice to get
don't take me as a classic. I feel bad.
If one means by violence a radical upheaval of the basic social relations, then crazy and tasteless as it may sound, the problem with historical monsters who slaughtered millions was that they were not violent enough. Sometimes doing nothing is the most violent thing to do.
You know where came the idea for this to me? From my own psychoanalysis, that's the tasteless personal problem. I remember, and you can imagine if you listen to me for 5 minutes, when I was in analysis, as you can imagine, I was talking all the time. But you know why? I looked into myself and immediately admitted to myself. Because what I was afraid is that if I stopped talking for a second, the analyst may ask me some really pertinent, unpleasant question. So the idea was I was hyperactive all the time.
I can relate.
Just so that things stay the same, that they don't move. And often I claim in social political life is the same. All the spectacle, yes, blah, 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 even leftist protests only are often, as I think I quote him here, as George Orwell nicely said, they are almost function leftist demanding change, a kind of a superstitious gesture. Like, if we talk about it, maybe it will not really happening, you know. So sometimes just to withdraw, not to do, is truly disruptive.
That's the real catalyst.
Yeah.
You had a question.
In a couple of your books, you've mentioned this idea of like militant passivity. Yeah. And I was wondering if that's some way related to the Che quote we started off the night with. And I was also wondering what sort of formula that we can come up with that can like differentiate between legitimate and illegitimate violence that avoids the pitfalls of just like an ethnocentric might is right sort of thing, but also stays away from just this extreme like cultural relativity.
Maybe a too complex question. I get it. It's a very good question. But first, all that problem of interpassivity and so on. This was the idea proposed by my good friend and young Austrian philosopher, Robert Faller. I really envy him. It's such an ingenious, simple idea. The idea is that our usual notion of interactivity, not in the sense of interacting TV, is interactivity in the sense of cunning confrisian, is I sit back and I let others do it for me. His idea was, what if today in our cultural life, more and more, and daily life, we have the opposite? It's not that the other does the work for us. It's that the other is passive for us. For example, my favorite example, I love it. This strange phenomenon from this ancient, like, praying meals or weepers, women you hire, how the other can do the mourning for you, the other can pray for you. But this is not only primitive societies. We have it the same. Remember canned laughter. For me, this is the greatest single American contribution to culture in 20th century. It's something very mysterious. You come in the evening home, tired as a dog, and the TV set laughs for you. It is totally wrong to think, as some idiots claim, that this is a kind of a Pavlovian way to make you laugh. No, maybe I'm a monster here, but I don't laugh. Why should I laugh when the TV set already laughs for me? And what's the mystery? Look into your heart, admit it, it's true. Is that even if you just look as an idiot and look at it and sit tired, at the end you feel relieved as if you have laughed. It's something very mysterious, this. And I wonder if you would agree here, that belief functions more and more like this today. We don't believe. We can be totally cynical and so on, but we need another one, which can be a real one, small children, an imagined one, to believe for us. Let me take, for example, I don't know, Santa Claus. I mean, of course you don't believe in it, but you say, I pretend to, so that not to offend my children. Wait a minute. If you ask your children, they would say, of course I don't believe it. I pretend not to disappoint parents and so on. You got it. Nobody has to believe, but the whole system of belief functions.
It's nonetheless very nourishing. Yeah. What you're talking about, among other things, is the heroism of the clergyman. People go to church and they know that everyone in the, or synagogue, and they know that everyone gathered there has questions, and they're aware of some of their questions that are being asked and some of the refusals of consent that are being made. But there's this sense that at least one person, you know, at least the preacher or at least the central figure is doing it, and you can relax, he's doing it for you, and the transaction as a whole still works, if only as a kind of canned laughter for the soul.
Yeah. Oh my God, I will quote you here. That's a wonderful expression. Yeah.
When I first moved to California, I had a sublet, a beautiful sublet in a home overlooking the Pacific, that had been vacated by one of television's leading laughter engineers. This is a man who traveled the country with his very high-class recording devices, and he recorded every known category of laughter. the laughter of giggling girls in high school assemblies, the nervous laughter of people hearing a joke told at a funeral. He had every category of laughing. He had them all carefully cataloged, and he would feed them in the appropriate age group. He even had recorded silence. I mean, if I asked you all to be absolutely silent, as quiet as you could be, and really we couldn't hear a pin drop, as we say. Still, there would be something different about this auditorium. Yeah. He would record that.
I'm so sad we don't have time to talk about these things more, because I would so much like to go in this direction. For example, a mystical phenomenon that my friend Michel Chion, theorist of sound, elaborated. You know, in concerts, how when you have a symphony between one and other movement, when you are not supposed to applaud, when the orchestra stops, you have all these sounds.
Yes, yes.
They are not, oh, people were postponing it. No, people are afraid of that silence. It's a desperate attempt to fill in the silence there. But another thing, if I may just repeat an old story, which I use just barely. This would be, for me, the formula of belief today, if you ask me. You know the story, maybe you know it, I'm sorry to repeat myself, it's a wonderful one. Niels Bohr, you know, quantum physics guy. Right. You know, when he was visited in his country house by a friend, and the friend saw above the entrance horseshoe, superstitious sign in Europe, item preventing evil spirits to enter, and the friend asked him, why do you have this? Aren't you a scientist? Niels Bohr answered, of course I am a scientist, I don't believe in this shit. The friend asked, but why do you have it? Ah, Niels Bohr answered, I have it there because although I don't believe in it, I heard that it works even if you don't believe in it. That's our ideology today. We don't believe in democracy, which is why if you want to see how ideology functions today, you don't have to read boring guys like us or whatever. Go to Hollywood movies and be attentive. Dark Knight. My God, it's a terrible movie. Did you get it? What's the message of the movie? Condoning lie as necessary to save social dignity. You know, at the end, how Batman assumed the murders to prevent. It's a terrible message. Even more, if you want ideology at its purest, and I know I've seen it 5 times because of my small son, Kung Fu Panda. Did you notice how strange the universe of the film is? You know that cartoon about big fat panda who becomes... On the one hand, all this sacred oriental spiritualism, kung fu, master, fate, and so on. At the same time, utter cynicism, jokes, making fun of anything. That's where we live today. The two can coexist. You can have it both. You can have all the dirty jokes, you know, that's what we call in psychoanalysis fetishist split. Je sais bien, mais quand même. I know very well, but nonetheless.
All the same, right.
Yeah.
All the same. Last question. Where are we? I can't.
I really must notice the right total here. Ignorance of the left here.
Okay, I would ask you to do a brief psychoanalysis of the potential disruptive or even transformative possibility on the body politic of understanding a very specific form of violence that's been used throughout history by those more shadowy, deeper Dick Cheneyan aspects of our governments, categorized under the torturous category of psychological warfare known specifically as false flag terrorism, a form of violence that is not only murderous, but also deceptive and purposefully traumatic on a group of people. And whether you are familiar with the people who are pointing to the long track record that the supposedly axis of good, which the wise Palestinian Hebrew once said, you know, the line between good and evil is in a man's heart, so it probably doesn't run through an axis of nations. Mm-hmm. Right, but that the, you know, British, the U.S., the Israelis have all been guilty of doing terrorism and blaming it on Arab people throughout the world. Even after 9/11, we've seen it. Are you familiar with that type of violence, and do you think that it has a potentially transformative possibility for the body politic, for the people to understand
there
that?
There was a lot of false flag terrorism, or at least charges of it, in the Balkans conflicts, wasn't there?
Yeah. No, again, you are asking me here, my God, two political questions. Of course, I am aware of all these dangers and so on and so on. But let me move to a topic which is closer to me, which may appear non-important, but for me is crucial. surface, the way we talk about things and so on and so on. People think this doesn't matter, but it does. Because, you know, when we say Guantanamo and all that stuff, then there are people who say, and maybe it's true, probably it's true from what I know, but Americans at least talk about it, debate. What about China? What about Russia? What about, I don't know, what African country where probably they torture infinitely more, but nobody...
Zimbabwe, right?
Yeah, yeah. My answer is the following one. Okay, that's another problem. What really worries me, and this is not as innocent as you may think, is that precisely we talk about it. Because, you know, how we act depends on how we talk about it. What worries me are changes in these unwritten rules of what it is decent publicly to talk about or not. Are you aware that this is a big change? Are you aware that if 10 years, 20 years ago at least, somebody would publicly defend the idea of torturing, he would be dismissed as a maniac. It was simply, in a good dogmatic sense, out of the question. It was almost like advocating, you know, debating... rape.
Infanticide or something.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't like to live in a society where one would have to argue all the time against rape. I would like to live in a society where if somebody advocates rape, you don't even have to counteract. He simply isolates himself, appears as a jerk, and so on. So what worries me is not so much for or against torture, but that torture became, Germans have this wonderful word, salon fake, appropriate for salon, educated debate, and so on. And here our lives are changing. And don't think this is just appearance, and so on, and so on. My God, what we do in reality, we do it always. It's always mediated by how we perceive things, and so on, and so on. The big lesson is here, Stalinism. Don't forget that Stalinism, which was, if ever, very brutal regime, was already the regime which was, and that's the mystery of Stalinism, not explained in the standard books like Robert Conquest, that Stalinism was at the same time extreme brutality, no problem, you risk millions, but extremely depending on appearances. Appearances had to be maintained as at all price and so on. It was as if... It's not true what they say, that Stalinism was brutal force in the West, you have manipulation. No, Stalinism was brutal force, but at the same time, in a total panic. Like if somebody publicly says, yes, as if everything would disintegrate. So I think we should well worry when, even if nothing changes in reality, we talk about things differently. Like global warming. Did you notice how in the last year, a significant shift in the public discourse. Till a year or two ago, global warming as catastrophic prospect was dismissed as some ex-communists exaggerating, apocalyptic. Now, in the last year, did you notice new tones? Everybody admits, from Bush downwards, there will be, but the message is, let's see, there are new opportunities. I saw an obscene report announced on CNN, the greening of Greenland. They say it's not only bad, they're already growing groceries on Greenland. If the polar ice melts, we will have fastest transport from China so that you will be able to enjoy order Gulag products for even lower prices and so on. I mean, this is for me ethically the most terrifying moment when something that up to a certain point we are well aware it's ethically unacceptable, impossible, unimaginable, all of a sudden is normalized. This is what worries me today. So even if nothing appears to change, these almost invisible changes worry me.
If I may end our conversation.
Now you will tell me what I really wanted to say. Okay.
Well, not quite, but I'm going to compliment you for a role that you play in your works and you've played this evening. And that is just the one that you played in this concluding remark, alerting us to changes in the way that we talk about things that we do talk about all the time, but don't notice when our discourse shifts and the likely consequences of what we say shift with that shift. The number of topics that Žižek will touch on in a single paragraph is astonishing, but they all are necessary for the discharge of this function, and I hope you continue to play it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.